This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Today on the show, Togusgai, Hereditary Chief of the Fire Wee Clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. Music by Resident Antihero and Shara Lang. This is Rage, building a community of resistance, one podcast at a time. Hello and welcome to Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Amiskwasibiskaigan. I am your host, Seymour Life, and a special hello to all those fighting for their traditional territories. This is a great interview with one of the most inspiring and thoughtful thinkers I have had the pleasure of meeting. Togusgai, Hereditary Chief of the Fireweed Clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, came and spoke at this year's Everyone is Downstream conference. I had the opportunity to interview him at the Remedy Cafe. I started by asking him to introduce himself.
Well, my name is Togusgai. I'm a hereditary chief from the Lhasa'amisu clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. And the Lhasa'amisu clan are what we call the Fireweed clan. I received the name a few years ago, but when you receive a name amongst our nation, it's very different from how patrilineal societies hand names to other people. But with the matrilineal society, when we get groomed into a name, it's a lifelong process of training an individual to take on a certain type of name, and are taught certain types of responsibilities when you take on those names. And as I was growing up, that's what happened to me. I was trained by my grandparents, trained by my father, and my mother's side of the family as well. They taught me a whole lot of things about the politics of being a Wet'suwet'en and how to carry yourself a certain way around other chiefs, and how to conduct yourself in a feast hall, how to make yourself accountable to your people. And that was the foundation of who I am and what I was raised to do as I was growing up. You know, I was very connected to the land. I'm still very connected to the land. And, you know, as I became an adult, I started to venture into a whole pile of different things. And eventually, I kept getting brought back to my people to do more work. I'd go away and do some training, come back and do work with their people again. Go away and do more training or get experience working for another organization somewhere, come back and work for people again. And I kept coming back with new tools and new ideas. And I helped set up one of the first traditional youth studies that were ever completed in British Columbia between 1995 and 1997. It was a traditional youth study that was done for the province of British Columbia on their behalf, so they would understand a lot more about who they're dealing with when they sit down at the negotiation tables with the Wet'suwet'en. This was before the Delk-Mulk decision came through. The Delk-Mulk decision came through in 1997, and it was considered a huge victory for the Wet'suwet'en and the Gitxsan people, our neighbors. But for our people, it was considered a huge victory, and you know, everybody was celebrating. Industry was busy doing their thing on our lands. They've been doing their thing in our lands for a really long time, since contact. And our people have just sat back and watched them rape and pillage our resources. And it broke my grandparents' heart. It broke my heart as growing up. My dad, you know, they all talked about how difficult it was to go out to places where they used to go and harvest certain types of species of animals or plants and medicines. And those places were being taken over by industry or agriculture or a few simple landowners coming in and putting no trespassing signs or just annihilating the landscape. And it was really, really hard for them to do that, to watch this happen in their life. I've seen it myself. I remember going hunting with my grandparents and beaver hunting in places where you can, you know, you walk in through the bush for a long ways and find a humongous beaver pond there. There's one particular place I remember seeing this at. We used to go there and harvest beaver every, it was my grandfather's territory. And we used to go harvest beaver there every spring. And we went back as an adult to have a look at the same site. And there was nothing left of it. The trees were all cut. The beaver ponds that were in there were drained. And in its place, there was cattle. And it really pissed us off because it was stink. You know, you try and get into this area and look around and there's nothing. All you smell is cattle shit everywhere. And I spent time with my grandparents talking about this kind of stuff. And they introduced me to other elders in our community. And those elders talked a lot about some of the things that were bothering them in their lifetimes and some of the things that they hope to see in their future. And I was kind of put into those positions to sit there and learn from our elders and take those stories and do something with it one day, because that's what they expect. My grandmother, you know, when she shared stories with me, or my grandfather shared stories with me, it was stuff, they shared it with me with the intent and the hope that I was going to actually do something with it one day. I remember hearing stories about a warrior society. I asked my grandmother, what did the warriors look like? And she gave me a very clear description of what the warriors looked like, what type of war paint they wore, what type of clothes, even their hair, how the hair was styled. And I asked her more questions about how did they organize, what did they do this, how did they organize that. And other elders also shared that same information with me. And we decided, I learned a lot about it. One of the things that I eventually went away and did some training in was anthropology. I got my undergraduate degree in anthropology. I learned a lot about social anthropology and physical anthropology. I was an archaeologist for 5 years of my life. Worked for an archaeological company out of Prince George in Vanderhoof. In the meantime, while I was in school, I was learning about social anthropology, and we were getting into ethnographic research type practices. And I went to Russia and did an amazing program out there in the Komi Republic, and came back and I wanted to do something more. I didn't want to just do physical anthropology, because basically you're working for industry and you're trying to accommodate industry with the buffer zones that you create when you find sites. And I was opposed to that as an Aboriginal person. That didn't sit well with me. I wanted to make a bigger difference, and I knew ethnographic research was going to be the way to go. So I learned a lot about the history of our people, sitting with elders, and they tell me lots of stories about how it was in the past. But ethnographically, I was able to go into archival repositories and do a whole pile of research and about our people. And some of the things I learned is back in 1820, that was the first time we had contact with the Western world. And shortly between 1820 and 1840, a large percentage, and I'm guesstimating that would be about 50% of our population, died from diseases that were brought in from the first colonists that made contact with us. Over the next 30 years after that, this is between 1820 and 1850, when the first disease epidemics came in and wiped out half of our people. But 30 years following that, other disease epidemics came in waves and continued to wipe out our people. And I heard stories. I remember reading a story from a Hudson's Bay Company fur trader named Trader Brown. And he, in his journal, wrote people, like, he set up the shop north of us in the Babine territory, the Nadotan territory. And he set up shop there, and he said that when the Wet'suwet'en traders came in, all the local people that were living around the trading fort picked up camp and moved away and made a humongous area so that the Wet'suwet'en people, when they came in, they set up shop and they started to trade with the company. And he said the Wet'suwet'en people, when everybody saw them coming, they would make way. And the talk in the camp was, the Wet'suwet'en people are here, nobody gets into their territory. If anybody gets into their territory, they're never seen again. And that was the message that the Trader Brown had. And that was his impression of the Wet'suwet'en people. And that was the story that I always heard from my elders. You know, our people were extremely fierce people. We never let anybody come into our territories. But it was that time period between 1820 and 1850 when half of our population vanished, died from diseases. All these stories about how our people die along with them. And our people just simply disappeared. They were gone. And that warrior society that existed back then, they were called the Thelan Lian. And the Thelan Lian are the guardians of the land. They're warriors. They're a warrior society. They had ranks. And their primary objective was to protect the integrity of their families, themselves, their families, the community, and the environment. Not necessarily in that order. All of them collectively were treated the same. And when that happened, industry made its way in around 1860. Industry made its way in comfortably into Wet'suwet'en territories. The territories were suddenly very porous. The boundary lines were porous. Industry came in, government workers came in, people from all walks of life came in and started setting up shop in Wet'suwet'en territory. And industry came in and railways came in, loggers came in, and they just started exploiting really quickly. Because suddenly this whole idea of terra nullius seemed to be real to them, because there was nobody there to chase them out. And the survivors of those epidemics, the survivors of our people, they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to make with it. because missionaries came in, and the missionaries coerced our people into making sure that we didn't interrupt what was happening with Western society as Western society made its way in. And that's evident just in the way that the term that we use for non-native people in our language, the common term amongst our people for non-native people is Nito. And Nito, if it's translated directly from Wet'suwet'en into English, literally means somebody who's higher than you. And that's a word that the missionaries told us to call the non-native people. We were taught to be subversive right from the very beginning. So industry came into our territory and started to wreak havoc, and they've continued this for a long time. Indian residential schools followed, the 60s scoop, trapline registration systems, a whole gauntlet of all these different things that destroyed the fabric, the cultural and social fabric of our people, came in and continued to do so for a long period of time. And it was around the time of the Delkamuk decision when our people decided to stand up and begin doing something about this. And we organized ourselves into a larger tribal group, and that larger tribal group tried its best to figure out how the white political systems worked, and see if they were trying to see if they can create a system that would kind of develop relations with the non-native society and hopefully begin making changes that will better our people. And they continued this for a long time. And while they were doing this, you know, our resources, you know, there was an obvious effort from the federal or the provincial government and their agencies to accelerate the exploitation of our resources. In my lifetime, I was able to see entire landscapes decimated. The biodiversity that existed there was impacted to horrendous degrees, and you know, they kept it that way. You know, they logged out large tracts of land, get rid of the biodiversity, and to ensure the biodiversity didn't come back, they came in with tree spacers and they made sure that they cut all the deciduous trees down. Mm-hmm. And the coniferans were allowed. It's a practice they did because they were trying to grow crops out of our trees. And our people sat back and just watched it happen. It continued to go on and on and on up until a couple of years ago when a good friend of mine, Mel, and myself decided that we were going to try and do something about this. And we decided to resurrect the old warrior society, the Lenin Society, and we began to do things. We began to organize rallies. We began to hold camps for youth and men in our communities and families and educate some of our own members about the history of our people. Where did we come from? What happened in our past? Why did we let industry come in? And what can we do about it? Do you want to let that happen? Or are we willing to actually stand up and help use your voice to say something and do something about that? And that was a movement that we started a couple of years ago. The Thay Lan Lian kind of rose up and decided to begin fighting industry. And at some point along the way, the Enbridge Pipeline came into the picture. The proposed Enbridge Pipeline, which is a northern gateway pipeline that's proposed to go from the tar sands here in Alberta all across BC to the coast of British Columbia and then a small town called Kitimat. The pipeline that they proposed is a dual pipeline. One pipeline carries condensate back to the tar sands, and that condensate gets mixed in with the tar sands and goes into the larger pipeline, bringing tar sands bitumen to the coast in British Columbia and put onto tankers. But when a tar sands bitumen gets to Kitimat, the condensate is removed from it and piped back to Alberta again. And this condensate, we know, primarily the source where they get a lot of the condensate is coming from Russia. And we know what condensate is. It's kind of like kerosene, but it's more toxic. It's something that we really, really don't want in our territories. That mixed in with the bitumen from the tar sands oil is something that just spells grave disaster for our people. And we started to fight this. And we held rallies in Terrace, in Smithers, and putting together rallies all over the place. Like we just started joining rallies. We started going to communities and educating our neighbors about what was going on. I had a chance to work a couple of years ago in Fort Chippewa, teaching an environmental monitor training program through Northern Lakes Community College to a group of young people that were in Fort Chippewa. And it was a 3-month project where I was teaching them about environmental monitoring. And that experience changed my life. I saw humongous tragedies happening not only in the community, but also with the students I was teaching. And when I left, I told them that my experience with them has changed my life, and I was going to do something about it. And that's what I did. I ended up coming back, and I worked really hard at getting Leyland Lien started and his proposed pipeline. And Enbridge wanted to run through our territory, as we knew it was going to contribute to the expansion of the tar sands, as well as the Kinder Morgan pipeline, which is also proposed to go through our territories. The Kinder Morgan pipeline, they already have a pipeline going down through Burnaby.
Okay.
But they want to put a larger pipeline right through the middle of our territories. They want to follow Enbridge's footprint. And Enbridge is looking at following another pipeline's footprint who received environmental assessment permits from the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agencies, as well as the BC Environmental Assessment Office. They gave them permits to put this natural gas pipeline through our territory. And we opposed that as well. I was a part of a project where we did some research with our people, and we found 100% of our people said absolutely no to natural gas pipelines coming through our lands. Our people also said the same about bitumen coming from tar sands. And Pembina is another pipeline that wants to put they want to put their footprint through traditional territories. And our people have said unanimously and consistently no to these pipelines. Yet the provincial government and the federal government are still trying to push their agenda through and push this pipeline through because they see it as economically viable for them, because they're going to receive a shitload of money from taxes off of the pipeline. The Enbridge Pipeline Corporation will have to pay the provincial government a whole pile of taxes every year, and they just see it as a cash cow. They're happy to see it go through. They want to see it. And our people have said, no, this land doesn't belong to you. We've never ceded it. We don't have any treaties. We've never signed any treaties. We walked away from the treaty in 2009, and we already have rights. We have existing rights. We have existing title. If we were to go through a treaty process, we'd be signing that stuff away, and we don't want to go through that. We don't want to lose rights that already exist with it. We have laws that are already functioning in our community. Our justice hall, our hall of justice, our governing system still exists. We call it the Batlats. Mm-hmm. It's a feasting system. We have potlatches that we still have every, like, once a month almost. There's always a potlatch happening in our community. And a potlatch is our form of government. It's where we enforce our laws. It's where we do business transactions. It's where we hire people and pay them to do different types of things. And it still exists. It's the way our people deal with our resources and have dealt with our resources. So that's what we're pushing for, is making sure that governing system begin to look after our land again, because our land has been decimated. And our leadership, the tribal organizations that set themselves up a while ago in our communities back in the 70s, have not been doing their job at protecting our lands. So the grassroots movement decided to stand up and do something about it. And we're pushing very hard to get our name out there in media, and our name out there with industry and with government, and letting them know that it's not going to be business as usual anymore. Things are changing on the landscape. Things are changing for the better, because we're in there primarily to protect our resources. And they're not just, I don't like using that word resources. It's a Western concept. Looking at objectifying the biodiversity that exists, because everything's living, everything's alive, everything has a right, everything should have a right to speak for itself, but it can't, because we don't all speak our language. So in a sense, the Leyland Lien and our group are focusing on giving the entities and our biodiversity and our ecosystems a voice, because nobody else is going to speak for them otherwise. So they just continue to get decimated. They're going through a lot more tragedies than our people did when the disease epidemics came.
I also asked about Tom Flanagan and his portrayal of warrior societies. I asked about allies, and I asked about the relationship between First Nations and ENGOs.
Tom Flanagan's a racist pig. He's always been racist. He befriends people like Manny Jules in the Kamloops area, and they're looking at trying to create some type of fee simple land system and get rid of the Indian Act and have Aboriginal people basically assimilate into Western society. And I hated that guy since I first heard about him. He came out to the University of Northern British Columbia while I was in university there to do some presentations, and we didn't hold back any punches. We hated the guy. We made sure he understood that he was not welcome, and any of his theories, any of his books, and any of the stuff that he's trying to present to Western society that was basically a racist picture that he was painting for Aboriginal people was not welcome there. I still despise the guy. He has no right to say what he says. He's one of the immigrants, I think, that need to be deported first when First Nations people take over lands. But people like that shouldn't be allowed to come around here and assume that just because we haven't done anything to date means that they can do whatever they want and say whatever they want. To me, allies who are willing to stop sitting back and hope that somebody else is going to put up the fight for them. There's a lot of people who are like-minded that want to see the integrity of the ecosystems and biodiversity protected, but a lot of people are sitting at home comfortably in their chairs or in a cafe or driving on to from work or sitting at work listening to a program like this and just hoping that somebody else is going to do the fight for them. And somebody else is going to continue the fight for them because they're going to sit on the sidelines and applaud what they're doing without actually contributing in it. And I was in that seat for a while. I was in that seat for a long time. I sat there waiting and hoping that somebody was going to put up a fight for the land because somebody had to at some point. And I realized that nothing was going to happen unless for myself, unless I initiated it because somebody had to do it. Somebody had to stand up and begin fighting for the land again. Somebody had to try and get up there and start protecting it because really, our climate is in crisis. We'd be idiots to think that it isn't. And we'd be idiots to sit back and allow somebody to try and present an argument to say that there is no climate crisis. There's a climate crisis sitting in front of us right now. We see it every day. Turn on the news, you can see all these incredible things happening around our planet right now that didn't happen before. And it's happening at an alarming rate. There's the scientists that talk about climate change, and some of them talk about this tipping point. I think we're really close to that tipping point if we aren't past it already. And we'd be fools to sit back and think that we can sit back and listen to our iPods and drive in our nice SUVs to and from work, hope that it's still going to be the same 3 or 4 years down the road. I don't think it's going to be that way. That's just a personal opinion of mine. I don't see a lot of hope for our future if we continue to do things the same way that we've been doing it for hundreds of years, because that's gotten us absolutely nowhere except in this dark hole that we're having a hell of a time trying to figure out how to get out of.
We talked
yesterday in everyone's downstream about ENGO accountability, and one of the things I brought up was the fact that we can't just sit there and think about ENGO responsibility or accountability without thinking about First Nations accountability. I love the idea that ENGOs are beginning, or this ENGO movement is beginning to move towards something that's more democratic and something that is going to be more accountable to the ecosystems, be accountable to First Nations rights issues, be accountable to First Nations sovereignty issues. I love that idea, but at the same time, I think it's important that First Nations people, the leadership, are accountable to their own membership. If the leadership people are used to making decisions without consulting with their membership on behalf of them, without, that especially if it's based on greed and based on selfish actions, then I don't see it working in the future. I see us sitting here 5 years down the road, if we're still around, arguing about the same bloody thing, because First Nations people didn't deal with the issues at hand properly. The leadership cannot continue to act as elitists, and elitists who are capable of, and have this right to sit down and make all the decisions on behalf of people without even talking with their people. That part needs to be sorted out. First Nations accountability has to be sorted out. And that's sort of an internal struggle that we have to deal with. That's something that First Nations people have to deal with. But we play one of the biggest cards right now in trying to find a way to save what's left of our planet. But in order to do that, we're going to have to really work our butt off to hold some people accountable for the decision-making process that they have. This adjudication process that ENGOs have to include First Nations people, but it also has to include First Nations elites and their membership, so that the membership have a chance. Like I said earlier, the reason why the Leilani'en decided to stand up and do something about it is because the elites were making decisions for us that weren't working. The Leilani'en decided to stand up as grassroots membership to say, we're tired of what's going on, we're going to start doing stuff on our own because what's going on isn't helping us. I'm a little bit leery about the fact that they may inadvertently get First Nations elitists, involved and making discussions and decisions on behalf of people that they don't really represent because they don't talk. So that's why I'm pushing for a grassroots movement. I think grassroots is going to be the way to go for a lot of First Nations people. If First Nations people really want to see a difference on their lands, don't sit back and wait for your leaders to make that difference, because they're not going to make it happen. They're only interested in making sure people's paychecks are made, especially theirs, and people's honorariums are paid so that they continue to do what they're doing. It's a status quo amongst First Nations groups, and you know, I don't mind saying that. You know, the skeleton's out of the closet, I'm fine with that. I think that needs to happen with NGOs too. NGOs need to have that same discussion and admit the same damn thing. Otherwise, we're really not going to get anywhere. We're going to sit here working and living in a lie. And it's better if we work and live in a truth that's based on grassroots actions and grassroots aspirations. We had a lot of discussion. I've been sitting with the NGOs and NGOs for a few years now, listening to how they want to see things unfold in the future. And a lot of it's based on theory that they share with each other. A lot of it's based on academic work that they do in the universities, doing research on, you know, the impact of environmental practices, industry practices on the environment. They focus a lot on this kind of a Occidental approach. They want to sit there and kind of place their. They want to pigeonhole all of these different things and try and make sense of it. And that's not the way First Nations people are. We see everything as a very, very interconnected. Very interconnected. We can't speak about one thing and exclude another. For example, if we're talking about the environment and protection of the environment, and maintaining ecosystems and finding strategies to develop those ecosystems and protect them, we can't talk about that in isolation of our social issues. Our social issues are very connected to that. Why? Because First Nations people are still very connected to our lands, the ones that live in rural settings. We're very connected to our lands. We know what's happening out there. We need to nurture people who nurture that part of our population who can maintain that, our trappers, our hunters, our fishermen. All these people need to be nurtured and kept out on our land so that they can tell us what the heck is going on out there. What changes are they seeing? When I talked about it being a life or death situation for First Nations people, it was something that came from one of the other people in our group. One of the other elders spoke and talked about this life or death struggle that we're facing. It's not academic. It's not any of the stuff these other people here in this room are talking about. This is a life or death struggle for us as Wet'suwet'en and as Chipewyan, as Lubicon, as Tahltan, as whoever it is that was in that room. It's a life or death struggle for us. And it's something that is absolutely true. Why? Because we're interconnected. We're very, very interconnected with the lands that we come from. We can sit down and say, our people have been here for 11,000 years, and this is why I know we've been here for 11,000 years. These are stories that we have. And they can share these stories. And scientists, like archaeologists, can sit and listen to them and go, holy crap. You know, the last time any of those types of animals walked this earth was 11,000 years ago. That's how old this story is. And the Aboriginal people can say, yeah, that's where we come from. That's who we are. And they can say that with pride, but also with a genuine connection. If you've ever seen a movie, Avatar, you see how these people get connected. It's kind of a silly way of doing it, but it articulates visually and the way our people are very connected to our lands. And, you know, spiritually, we're very, very connected to our lands. Physically, everything about who we are comes from the land that we come from. And when we talk about being a life or death situation, if we lose those territories, if you lose it to industry, to pollution, then that means we lose everything about who we are as whoever we are, First Nations, whichever organization or whichever tribal group that we come from. We lose that and we're dead.
We are standing before the forces of power. We're on the move now. therefore the force is the power.
Resident Antihero with Don't Let Him In, which I think is a fitting song for not allowing the Northern Gateway Pipeline to cross Alberta and enter into British Columbia. Every person within the colonial institution of Canada, or North America for that matter, that benefits from stolen Indigenous land, and let's be clear, it is all their land, have an obligation to stop the destructive industrial practices that are affecting First Nations people, and to stop these tendrils of industrial civilization, like the pipelines, from entering Indigenous territories if they don't want them on their land. Taking us out is Shara Lang with Skyline. Remember, folks, the resistance needs you.
In where